Caroline, Willie, D. Mace, 102.5, 106.3, The Game, and The Game Nashville app. We are live from the Hiller Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, and Electrical Game Studios, which today is Pete and Terry's Tavern at Bridgestone Arena. The Predators in action tonight, 7 o'clock against the Pittsburgh Penguins. What a wild weekend of college football. We had the Iron Bowl come down to a 4th and 31. We had Washington State come down to a field goal where Michael Penix Jr. couldn't even watch it. We had Michigan-Ohio State, which that's all you really need to say with that matchup. And then, of course, to cap off the most dramatic day of the college football season, we had what I'm going to call affectionately Mark Stoopsgate. But joining us now to break it all down is Mitch Light of The Athletic. Mitch, appreciate you for joining us. Hope you enjoyed your Thanksgiving weekend. I want to start here with Texas A&M. It was reported that Mark Stoops was going to be the guy, and then, just kidding, never mind, a few hours later, it was Mark Stoops wanted to stay at Kentucky, Texas A&M went back to the drawing board, and then it was announced yesterday that Mike Elko, former defensive coordinator at Texas A&M and head coach at Duke, will be the head coach at Texas A&M. What did you make of all of that? What did you make of the potential hire of Mark Stoops and now the ultimate hire of Mike Elko?
Well, I think the Elko hire I like a lot. I don't know if we talked about it, but several weeks ago, once they made the move, he would have been the first guy I talked to. But Texas A&M, being that it's Texas A&M, could not do something without drama. So they ended up with a very, you know, sane, normal hire. But of course, the roundabout way they got to that route, you know, with infighting and, you know, do we really want to hire Mark Stoops and all this? And, you know, you could argue. Now, I like Elko, but you could argue that Mark Stoops is just Elko with 10 more years of experience or whatever it is as a head coach. I mean, very similar kind of backgrounds, and they look, you know, similar demeanor and all that stuff. But I really like Elko. I don't think it's, like, mandatory that you have experience at Texas A&M like he does, but I think it helps. That's a kind of a unique culture down there. He's recruited, you know, he's recruited in Notre Dame. He's recruited at Duke, Wake Forest. He's an Ivy League guy, Jersey native. So, you know, obviously he's got a lot going for him right there. So, I'm just really impressed with what Duke did. You know, everyone loves David Cutcliffe, but that program had fallen on really hard times when he got there. They were really bad the last couple of years, got good immediately. And I kind of applaud Texas A&M for not falling off the Elko bandwagon, even though Duke struggled down the stretch. You know, their quarterback got hurt, Riley Leonard. You could see why they weren't as good, because his record's not great. I think they went 7-5 this year. So, again, long-winded answer, Caroline. I really like the hire. I think he's a good fit there, and he brings kind of some normalcy to that program.
And, by the way, yes, Mitch is from New Jersey, slipping that in there. I heard that.
Yes. And before we go on, I have something very important to ask Caroline.
Yes.
I need some guidance. I can't disclose who my Heisman vote is. You're not allowed to do that. But do you have any suggestions, maybe? Who I should go for?
You know, she already said it before you even.
Yeah, she already said it.
Jane Daniels. Yeah. Okay. I went on a diatribe this morning. I do a hit with Robbie and Rexford every morning on Tuesdays. I went on a diatribe of my campaign for Jaden Daniels. I mean, the stats aren't even close. Passing stats are close. The rushing stats completely set Jaden Daniels apart. He's gone against tougher defenses. LSU has the number one strength of schedule. Jaden Daniels has better stats against top 25 opponents. The only thing holding him back is the fact that Jaden Daniels can't play defense.
Well, maybe if he played defense, you know, the little Travis Hunter action, he'd have better shot. But
he might be a better option than what LSU's gotten defensively.
I will take your suggestions under advisement as I move
forward. I will
send
you a full report, and I will have that to your email by end of day.
Thank you very, very much. I will review it with my team.
Vanderbilt, Tennessee. I mean, I said earlier that I saw Clark Lee's face reach shades of red that I didn't even know were humanly possible, and I watch LSU and Brian Kelly every single
week.
It was the two back-to-back, you know, calls that were blown dead, and then, you know, of course, Tennessee players, they're playing defense. Clark Lee gets angry. He gets frustrated. What was a first down then turned into, what, a third and 39. What did you make of that situation from, you know, just a college football perspective and also from a Vanderbilt perspective?
Yeah, so a little caveat, I've told you guys, like, my work Saturdays, sometimes I'm, like, sitting around doing nothing but watching games, and sometimes I have to work for, like, an hour. And this was a time when I was kind of busy. So, like, I had it on, the game on. I definitely watched it, but I wasn't, like, honing in, like, replaying. Could you hear the whistle and all that stuff? So, you know, it looked – the first one looked pretty bad, you know, the way A.J. Swan's demeanor. You know, you can see when a quarterback has given up on a play, like there's a whistle. Like, I don't think you need to hear a whistle if you're a defensive player when you see a quarterback just in that, and everyone stopped. So it's difficult not being there and, you know, because really it's loud and you can't really hear. So I understand Clark Lee's frustration 100%. I mean, the season they've had there. And then you think you know, as he said, he's trying to protect his guys. And I have been, you know, down on the sidelines where I was a sideline reporter for Vanderbilt for 7 years. So some good teams and some bad teams. And there's no doubt when you're having a bad season and then you're losing a rivalry game like that. And, you know, you can't really exact revenge on the field because you're getting beat bad. There's frustrations that, you know, boil over and, you know, the offensive linemen, you know, trying to protect their quarterback. So I'm not surprised it got to where it got after those two hits. Again, I'm not saying they were, you know, warranted or unwarranted, you know, just watching them, they seem unwarranted, but it's just frustration. I don't think the officials did the best job possible of controlling the situation there. So, you know, I applaud Clark Lee for defending his guys. I'm sure a lot of that was frustration and just a frustrating way for Vanderbilt's really disappointing season to end.
Now we got championship weekend coming up, and I think every game this weekend, Georgia, Alabama, Michigan, Iowa, Washington, Oregon, Florida State, Louisville. Those games are going to be must watches because obviously whoever loses, they end up out of the college football playoffs. Which team you believe is in the most danger? Is it, I believe it's Washington and Oregon, but Iowa is a good team. They're one of the best defenses in college football in regards to points. Does Michigan have anything to worry about with that one? But the way I'm looking at it, I think the one team is Washington and Oregon.
Yeah, the spread jumps out at you in that game, Derek. It's 9 points or whatever it was. You know, Washington beats Oregon, what, about 6 weeks ago. But as I always say, like, we kind of make fun of the committee sometimes in some of their terms, but I'm kind of a fan of game control. Like, it's not just did you win your games? I know that's the ultimate goal, but how did you look doing so? And Washington, give them all the credit in the world, they have been playing with fire for multiple weeks now, and they almost got burned last week. I think they're better than TCU, but they're sort of like the TCU team of last year. You know, they found ways to win. You look at TCU, they won by 7 points, 3 points, walk-off field goals at Baylor. You're like, you know, they ultimately lost their championship game and still got in. And I think Washington's a better team, but there's a reason the line is 9 points. You know, Oregon, if I'm talking game control, Oregon has been dominating every game. They've been maybe the most impressive team in the country since that Washington game there. So I'm really fascinated to see what happens here. You know, Washington can kind of shut us all up because everyone's picking Oregon. I just love the winner-take-all part of that game. Now, if Washington loses, are there scenarios where they might have a shot? I guess. Obviously, if Oregon loses, they're done. But to your Michigan-Iowa, I would be shocked if Iowa was competitive in this game. They're just – they were a bad offensive team. They were healthy. Yeah, when they were healthy with Cade McNamara and Eric Ault, the tight end, you know, Deacon Hill, that quarterback, I mean, I'm sure he's a nice guy, but he should not be playing quarterback in a league championship game. I mean, if you watch that Nebraska game, that was atrocious offensive football there. So, you know, they might muck it up and make things difficult for Michigan, but I think this is going to be like a 21-3 type game. I'd be shocked if Iowa was competitive into the fourth quarter.
Now, is Georgia the only team that could theoretically lose and still make the college football playoff? I'm talking amongst the top four undefeated teams.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think we assume because it's the SEC and Georgia, like, it's very difficult, but you sort of have to remove Georgia, two-time defending national champs, and treat them for who they are this year. Like, if you're comparing a one-loss Georgia team and a one-loss Washington team, I don't know that Georgia has a better resume than Washington. I think they're a better team. I think the middle of the middle of the Pac-12 is better than the middle of the SEC this year. And the Georgia's best wins are what, Missouri and Ole Miss at home. Two very solid teams. So I think that would be really, really interesting. If Georgia loses, I think they would get in. I think they'd get the benefit of the doubt, and it's very difficult. There's the human element of, like, not removing the fact that they're the two-time defending national champs, but that's what you have to do. I mean, I watched a decent amount of the Georgia Tech game. Georgia Tech's fine, solid, you know, average team. They did not have much trouble moving the ball in Georgia. So it was sort of that Georgia team earlier in the year rearing its head, where they're kind of messing around. They weren't dominating like we'd seen them do in the previous month.
That's a really interesting point. So do we think if Alabama wins, it's automatic that they're in?
I do. I think the SEC – you mean if Alabama wins, automatic that Alabama's in?
Yeah.
Or yes, I would think the SEC champ with a win over Georgia. Now, I'm just sitting here telling you how I don't think Georgia's like the best team in the history of the world. But, a win over Georgia with what they have done. You know, I'm looking at their resume. You can make the same arguments about lack of quality wins. They did lose to Texas at home. I think, I'm sure you guys have been talking about it all week. We've talked about it. The committee looks – there are more scenarios this year where the committee has to make very difficult decisions.
Yes.
If we're looking at this honestly, there have not been very many difficult decisions in the 10 years or whatever it was. The first year was very tough, when TCU and Baylor got left out. But last year, Ohio State made it basically because there weren't enough good teams. And TCU was like a 3 seed, and they lost their conference championship game. So there's a committee. There's 13 people, I believe. It's not one person. Sometimes we think it's just, they say this team's better. Well, there could be 7-6. There could be a lot of discussion going on there. And it's, there's coaches in there. There's administrators. What do you value? Do you value game control? Like, do you dismiss Alabama's win against, like, not dismiss, but you say, it doesn't matter. It's a rivalry game. They won in Auburn. Or do you look and say, hey, Auburn lost to New Mexico State the previous week. They only beat them by three on a miracle. This is not a great team. So there's so many different ways to look at these teams.
And along those lines, I think because of what you just said, Mitch, there's so many teams that have an argument. Mm-hmm. I wonder how each committee member feels about the value of the league championship as opposed to being on the outside looking in. Like Ohio State probably sitting there going, we've lost one game. It was at Michigan. It was right down to the last possession. It was a game that seesawed back and forth. It was a good game, but they're not in the championship game, but people have made it like that before.
Yes, we have. But I think last year they made it because there weren't other suitable teams. Like, I think they would take a conference champion. I see what you're saying. Ohio State, you could step back. Ohio State has one good win. They beat Penn State. And they had the opportunity and they lost to Michigan. So I think they're in a tough spot. One other thing, too, and, Texas is sitting out there. Texas might end up being the best team of the college football playoff era not to make it. And,
yeah.
You can do the whole Texas versus Alabama thing. Head-to-head is really only something you look at when two teams are considered even by the committee. I think Texas's problem is they're not going to be compared to Alabama because if Alabama wins, I think they might be the 2 seed behind Michigan or maybe the 3 seed. And Texas is going to be compared to maybe a, Florida State. See what I'm getting? So, like, if they're comparing Texas and Alabama, then I think Texas has a – they won in Tuscaloosa. But I think if Alabama's in the playoff, they will be ahead of Texas on the committee's food chain, so that head-to-head doesn't really come into play, if that makes sense.
Like you're saying, I think what you get into this cycle of the group of teams as opposed to one team sitting there going, we've got one loss, Alabama's got one loss, we're a league champ, they're a league champ. We won there. We won. That's going to get hairy if it gets to that. So along those lines, let's hit one more. How did you think Florida State looked against, in a rivalry game, a very motivated Florida team, hostile atmosphere? How did you think they looked without their quarterback?
Another great example. Let's say we're in the committee, Willie. I'm sitting there saying, you know what? They didn't have their quarterback. Florida's didn't have its quarterback. Florida's 5-7, and they barely won in the Swamp. And then you're in the across the conference room table. You're saying, what are you talking about? You ever been to Gainesville? That's a rivalry game. You go down there with the quarterback making his first start of the year, all the pressure in the world. They fall behind, 12-0, come back and win. That showed so much guts. So, there's just different ways to answer the question. I am in the latter camp right now. Give them the benefit of the doubt because they did come back, because they did beat Florida at the Swamp, but they'll have an opportunity this week against Louisville. I think Louisville's actually a good barometer for them. Like, if we think Florida State is a legit college football playoff team, even with your backup quarterback, you go win that game by 10 points. Now, Louisville's solid, but they just lost to Kentucky, So, if they struggle, then I think that opens the door. Now, I think I don't see many scenarios where undefeated Florida State does not make it, but I think the committee would either like to see them lose or win by 2 touchdowns and say they've proven that they can be a good team without them.
Yeah, so style points could come into play here this weekend.
Yeah, I totally think so, especially you know, when you're comparing all these different scenarios. But, you know, we have not seen a situation like Florida State where a team has lost its quarterback with two games to go. You know, people compare it to Ohio State. But Ohio State in 2014, but Cardale Jones like came in the championship game and they won big and they proved they were still a very good team without him. They've yet to prove that they're a very good team without Jordan Travis.
Now, what do you think of Michigan State's hire, Jonathan Smith? And do you believe that Ulunglele, I think I pronounced that right.
You're close.
Yeah,
you're close.
I'm in the ballpark. I know who you're talking about.
That could be.
I am in the ballpark with his name.
I'm giving him the award for the toughest name for an announcer to call in the history of college football.
Ayamaleava is up there.
Yeah, that one is.
Okay,
too,
so we'll, he'll make his case in the coming years. Yes.
But
Uyunglele.
Would it be smart for him to leave and go to State? Because I'm trying to figure out whether this is going to be a good marriage, knowing that the offense that they run is more of a pro-style offense, which is working for Oregon State so much so they've already won eight games. But will that translate when he gets into the Big Ten, or does he need to open it up a little bit more?
Well, you know, caveat, all coaching hires, we don't know. You know, we think we know. But on paper, this is really solid. He's extremely well-respected, does more with less. You know, they have not, I don't think they've signed a top 50 recruiting class since he's been there, and they've had top 20 teams. We saw what the league was this year. So I think it was fortunate. Now, I'm not saying he would never leave Oregon State for Michigan State, but the fact that the Pac-12 is falling apart, I mean, you have an opportunity to get a guy who played quarterback at Oregon State. You know, 2 years ago, if you asked an Oregon State fan, was John Smith going to leave us for Michigan State? That it's, you know, you're crazy. But the circumstances have changed. So I think he is a really solid hire. He's obviously coming to a new part of the country. He is a Southern California native who's been in the Northwest. He was an offense coordinator at Boise State in Washington. I'm not the biggest DJU fan. Like, I'm not saying they can do, like, better. I mean, I think they can do better.
Well, the states that their quarterbacks are in the portal. Hauser jumped in a portal, so they're going to need some help.
Right, they will. And, like, so John, we'll find out, I guess, what Jonathan Smith thinks of DJU. You know, we're not guaranteeing that he wants to go there, but if he wants his quarterback and he brings him along, then he probably said, you know what, I got a new system I'm bringing in. I want this security blanket with my new quarterback. So, you know, that's something to monitor. But I think a really good hire. And one thing about Jonathan Smith, like, I've never met him, talked to him, but I know a lot of my colleagues at The Athletic have told me this. He might be the most normal Power Five college football coach. He's just a very normal dude in the profession with huge egos and guys who go, you know, whatever. He just seems like a really down-to-earth, really solid guy. But, Derek, I guess you don't really care. You want a guy who's going to win 10, 11 games, right?
All I know is this. If DJU comes to Michigan State, we're all going to have to practice saying it because Derek's going to be bringing this guy up every week.
Absolutely.
Speaking of the portal, Mitch, I know that's probably the biggest topic in college sports, right, is two things, the portal and NIL. Mm-hmm. And there's all this alarming numbers, the portal. There's too many people in the portal. There's people that never come out of the portal. Are we going to see, despite all that, a record number of people in the portal when it's all said and done, like a new high? I feel like it's going that way.
Yeah. I mean, there's no evidence.
There's no turning back.
But there's no turning back. Yeah, we're already seeing it, and it's every school, you know, every fan base, like, oh, our guy's leaving the portal. What's with our coach? No, it's happening everywhere. And I think we are going to start to see a trend of coaches being – now everyone's going to utilize the portal to plug some holes, but I think the major portal teams taking 10, 15 guys, my personal opinion – I think it's going to swing. The momentum's going to swing, or the pendulum's going to swing the other way a little bit, programs are going to start to realize that high school recruiting actually is the foundation. That it's difficult. The quarterback is one thing, a wide receiver to plug in, but look at Colorado. Look at teams. It's very difficult to rebuild an offensive line. USC is a great example. They brought in some highly regarded offensive linemen, but their offensive line struggled all year. Their offensive line was really good last year because they had guys who had been in the program 3 or 4 years. This year, it struggled. It's very difficult at certain positions to have that continuity. So I actually think that we're going to see some teams start relying less on the portal, my personal opinion. But that doesn't mean it's going to slow down the amount of kids going into the portal because, you know, everyone thinks their case is different. Everyone thinks it's got someone in their ear saying, you need to go there. And obviously we know the tampering. You know, and I'm not there's a recruiting analyst who I respect. He does a really good job, but tweeted something out today about a certain quarterback saying who's not in the portal yet, saying, I've been watching some film. This guy would be a really good fit at this school and this school. And I was just like, okay, we've got a national recruiting guy who's watching film of a guy who's not in the portal saying he's going to be a good fit at these two schools. Like, I don't blame the guy that's just doing his job, but, like, what are we doing here? The guy is in, you know.
Right.
He's not
it makes you
portal.
Wonder, are those schools saying, hey, if you put this out there, maybe the guy, you know, you just wonder what all goes on in that game behind the game.
Exactly. And I mean, I'm not naive. I know that the tampering exists and – especially, and I think one other thing, I think we're going to see like the NIL trend of more schools getting wiser, the more NIL dollars are going to go to transfers even more. I think teams have realized that I'm not saying recruits aren't getting NIL, high school recruits getting promises and all that, but it's just like a much more sound investment to put it toward a guy who's at least proven he can play in college.
And if you're a quarterback, it's tough to not look at the recent history of the quarterbacks that have found the most success. I mean, look at the three leading Heisman contenders. Michael Penix, Bo Nix, Jaden Daniels, all transferred. You know, last year, Caleb Williams, of course, he followed his coach, but transferred to USC, won the Heisman Trophy 2019. Joe Burrow transferred. You know, Kyler Murray kind of transferred, but did transfer.
Baker Mayfield transferred.
Yeah. Jalen Hurts transferred. It's almost like the recipe to success for quarterbacks is to transfer, but then you look at guys like Bryce Young, Carson Beck. I mean, Bryce Young won the Heisman, stuck around.
Stetson Bennett technically transferred.
Stetson, and then came back. But Mitch Light covers college football for The Athletic. Mitch, appreciate you as always. We'll chat next week.
All right, guys. Take care.
Yep. Appreciate it. All right. Coming up next, we will chat with Clark Lee. We'll get his thoughts on what he saw on the field in Neyland Stadium this past week and also the latest with the Vanderbilt Commodores football program. Clark Lee coming up next. Caroline Valenti-Mace, 102.5, 106.3, The Game.